nice of you here. Sorry I'm late. Had something that I couldn't ignore. Alrighty, this is checking in number 1537 of the series that began in September of 1982, 32 years ago. It's Sunday night in New York City, and we're starting the TechNet. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is education. There are college professors out there who tell their students that if you really want to see what radio is really like, listen to the TechNet. There are 26 different kinds of ham radio, and we try to cover many of those kinds. The people who gather here share knowledge as to how radio really works. Let me drop it. The schools that supposedly teach us radio electrical engineering, wireless technology, do, in my opinion, a less than mediocre job. They're stuck in the tradition. A tradition they established way back in 1947, and they changed it very little since. And it's time for a change. In my experience with radio for the last 40 years, radio equipment as an engineer, I've discovered that people who run anechoic chambers have got an extremely deep set of traditions. You try to make any kind of a change and they think you're breaking the law and everything's going to crash and burn. They have that opinion. And so some of my best work is where I force people who work with anechoic chambers, antenna testing laboratories, in other words, to think out of the box and do things differently. By the same token, the methods by which we teach the radio science needs a lot of improvement. The people who are teaching it in the colleges act as if there is no feedback required. No information need be gathered from industry as to how they can do it better, how they can give the students useful engineering information, as opposed to what they think is the so-called foundation for electronics, which is too many steps back. Okay, that's one of my personal pet peeves, as you can tell. We did have a W2LYY Joe who signed in last week. And so he's the first on the list this week. We also have Vito, who's going to give us a quick discussion on potentiometers. That is, we're going to get into a discussion on potentiometers because of Vito's question. Let me drop. And a potentiometer is one of the many components to use in electronics that is quite often misunderstood. It's got a lot more magic in there than first meets the eye. And the word potentiometer really is a three-terminal resistive device with a slider, usually a rotary knob on the front of it. And there's a large number of ways that it can be used. You wire it a particular way, and it's called a rheostat. You wire it another way, it's a linear or a logarithmic volume control. What's the best impedance for your particular potentiometer? Should it be 100 ohms, 1,000 ohms, 10,000 ohms, half mega ohm? There's an advantage of each one of those numbers for a potentiometer. So it's one of the many things we use. We take, we sort of ignore it. We don't give it second thought. That volume control, that's adjust the audio volume or the RF gain or the center frequency control or many of the other things on our rigs that have analog controls, the few that still do, squelch control and so on. Those potentiometers quite often are wired in slightly different ways. They do a similar sounding function, but not necessarily by the same technique. Okay, let me drop. A person who does have a question or a comment for the group called the Technical Net that meets in New York City at 8 o'clock every Sunday night for the last 32 years. If you've got a question or a comment, now's the time to sign in. Give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. We've already got W2RYY and Vito. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
KC2SHO, yes.
KC2, Foxtrot Hotel, Oscar. I should know your name, and you didn't say it, sir. Please tell me your name.
Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel, Oscar. The name is John here, Mount Laurel, New Jersey.
Very fine, John. You're sounding very good from Mount Laurel. Since I didn't hear any beep, I guess you're signing in by way of Echo Link. Okay, we've got three people signed in so far. Anyone else that's got a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2
Paul with a space report. Leaving deck, John, Al.
Yeah, we're going to be looking forward to that, Paul. New Horizons, that's a magic piece of space hardware that's about to go whizzing by Pluto at around July 4th or so this year. We'd like to hear more about that. I always ask Paul, what's the latest with Voyager? The most far-reaching piece of hardware that mankind has ever issued. And it has left the building. The Voyager spacecraft is out of this solar system. It's into interplanetary space. It's into interstellar space, way out there in the rest of the galaxy, 8 billion miles away. What a piece of hardware. 37 years and still cranking. A QRP rig that gives you a tiny signal, and NASA can still talk to it every day if they want to. Beautiful piece of hardware. All right, anyone else to give me your call letters and name because you have a question or a comment? Give it to us right now. K2RIW. Okay, there being none. Oh, by the way, later on, after we go through our question and answer period, anybody who has gone to the Ham Radio University today, I'd like to hear your comments. How well did you like it? You think things that should change? What lectures did you attend? Did Andy do a good job for the 11th year in a row of teaching you how to do fox hunting and so on? Did you get a chance to see that display of the Green Sky Project? So give us your comments a little bit later on. So start thinking about what you're going to tell us. Now, Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. You got the floor, and tell us your question and your subject. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. W-H-O-R-Y-Y. Name is Joe. For everybody else who doesn't know me, I'll be out there. I'm sure a lot of people do. My question has to do with measuring frequency accuracy. And I'm trying to use a couple of carriers, many carriers off the air. And what I'm encountering is many of the carriers, as far as I can determine, seem to be on the same frequency, but a few are off a little bit one way or the other way. And I guess the question is going to be, how do you really determine the frequencies I'm using, which ones are going to be, I guess you could assume, be fairly correct. And I'm talking about fairly correct down to, you know, a very, very small percentage on the frequency. Like within a half a hertz measurement on over the air or less than that. What I'm using, Dick, is using two television carriers of that spike that appears at the low end of all these digital carriers that I can detect off the air. And I'll go into a little further detail, but that's basically my question. If you'd like further information as far as specific details on the carriers and differences I see on them, I'll forward that to you also here.
Now, frequency measurement and its accuracy is one of the art and sciences of radio from the very beginning. In the very beginning, you didn't have a frequency counter. You didn't have pieces of electronics, tubes or transistors or whatever, that could go that fast. The thing you could measure is wavelength. So in the very beginning, you use something like electro wires or the equivalent of a slotted line, and you move some kind of a probe along a transmission line, and you moved until you got either a peak or a null, and then you moved a little bit further until you got another peak or another null, and the difference between those two on a transmission line of known velocity factor, the difference between those two peaks and those two nulls was a half wavelength. So in the very beginning, you could measure wavelength. Therefore, we called it the 20-meter band and the 80-meter band and the 10-meter band, because that's how many meters, or one-half of that number of meters, is what you would measure when you move your detecting device along your frequency-measuring apparatus, which usually was electric wire or the equivalent of a modern-day slotted line. Let me drop. And you'll notice that as we go up in frequency, in other words, each decade, the highest frequency the radio people use, maybe it's a decade and a half, but just like every 2 years you double the number of lines of code or the number of transistors in a microprocessor, that's Moore's Law. Well, there's an equivalent that doesn't have a name, I don't think, where
what's the highest frequency we use, and we've got good equipment for measurement. It goes up roughly 10 times every decade or decade and a half. Back in the early days when I was cutting my teeth on radio, anybody who got above 500 megacycles was deep into the microwave band. Microwave meaning the wavelengths are starting to get so small, down to the centimeters and millimeters, that they thought it would be very hard to measure. Nowadays, we think nothing about talking about the 450 gigahertz band. And the 430 gigahertz, there happens to be a ham band there, by the way. However, when it comes to really counting frequencies, and now you can, by way of heterodyning technique, you can really count frequency up to a terahertz and a little bit beyond. But beyond that, the light frequencies, we still measure them in wavelength. The middle of the optical band you're using, your eye uses, is 550 nanometers of wavelength. That's the optical equivalent of a 20-meter band, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. I predict the day will come. With good laser heterodyning techniques and other fancy things that are yet to be developed, we will eventually be measuring frequency. 550 nanometers is somewhere around 10 to the 15 hertz. In other words, one with 14 or 15 zeros after it is the number of hertz or cycles per second that the optical frequency operates at. You think light and radio and power line frequencies are different. It's all the exact same spectrum. Start off at 60 hertz, you go higher in frequency, you eventually call it radio. Go higher in frequency, you eventually call it microwave, millimeter wave. Go higher in frequency, we call it light. The exact same electromagnetic wave going through the air or whatever substance. And you use different kinds of detectors. Your eyeball and the retina at the higher frequencies and so on. So frequency, nowadays, we're getting smart enough to measure the cycles themselves because of all the things mankind measures, arguably the thing we measure with the greatest amount of accuracy is frequency. The National Bureau of Standards, let me drop. The National Bureau of Standards can measure frequency to approximately 14 decimal places. You get the most accurate micrometer or any other kind of mechanical measuring device you can envision, and you will probably have trouble getting beyond 4 or 5 decimal places. And yet we measure frequency by the National Bureau of Standards to numbers like 14 and 15 decimal places. Tremendous accuracy. And is that the limit? Of course not. There's some articles written recently about where the NBS is coming up with better frequency standards than the cesium beam standard, which used to be the best, and now they're coming up with even better molecular standards. So when it comes to measuring frequency, when it comes to measuring cycles per second, you have to have a reference, and there's the problem. Let me drop. Rarely is your frequency measuring accuracy and statistics of that accuracy, rarely is it any better than the accuracy with which you know as the reference. Now, using the pilot tone on digital television as a reference is a good reference. It's not the world's best. Depending on which network you're listening to, some networks are considerably better than others. If Eric KE2EJ is available, who is the chief engineer for both Channel 13 in New York City and Channel 21 UHF channel on Long Island. As I said, as the chief engineer, he keeps his ear glued to the ground as to what's the latest in hardware that's being used in the broadcast industry and frequency accuracy, and whether or not you're meeting the FCC standards along those lines is something to be definitely discussed. And different networks have higher and higher accuracies. So, assuming you can get your hands on what you to be an extremely accurate frequency reference, assume you can get your hands on one of those. And now, by various techniques, by heterodyning and other things, you measure the frequency difference between either your standard and the thing you want to know, or the harmonic of your standard and the thing you want to know. So by measuring the frequency difference, it's really at least a two-step process. You start off what you think is a good standard, what you think you know the accuracy of. You then measure the difference between it and your unknown. And now just the process of measuring that difference, the internal counter of your circuit that's measuring the difference in frequency, which is another kind of counter, it has a built-in reference. Maybe it's a 10 megacycle, ovenized reference oscillator made by Hewlett-Packard, but you had to worry about the accuracy of it. So there's a whole bunch of things coming together where you can...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, looks like we still got the Eastern repeater. There's a whole bunch of individual steps of individual accuracies, which the statisticians, what they usually do when you have a number of unknowns, where you know the accuracy or the apparent accuracy of each one of those, you do a root sum squared function. In other words, there's a mathematical function by which you combine the individual elements of inaccuracy, by which you make a good prediction. It's not perfect, but it's a good prediction. And lots of things are a prediction. I'll give you an example of that one. Let me drop it. The very next roll of that roulette table at a gambling casino, you haven't the vaguest idea which one of those slots that ball's going to fall into. However, you do that experiment 1 million times in a row, and with high accuracy, you can predict how often it's going to fall into each one of those. So statistically, you know something, even though the individual event you don't know. Similarly, when you make a whole lot of frequency measurements, you can add up all the individual inaccuracies. I say add up, compare all the individual inaccuracies, and you can come up with an assessment on how good is your system for measuring frequency. As you know, the American Radio Relay League does periodically hold frequency accuracy measurement tests in which Newington, Connecticut, they will transmit a particular frequency at a known frequency region for a known period of time, and you as a contestant in that competition will use whatever equipment you've got to do the best job you can of measuring that frequency, and you report it, and pretty soon they announce who is the first, second, and third winner in accuracy of measuring frequency. It's something that's never going to be perfect, but as you use better and better techniques and better accuracy of reference oscillators, you can get closer and closer. Let me drop. There's a guy I knew, I wish I could remember his call letters, who lived in Connecticut roughly 15 years ago, who was using satellite television, television receive only terminals, 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz downlinks of broadcast synchronous orbit satellites, and he was measuring the frequencies coming out of those satellites. And by the method by which he was measuring those frequencies, he could tell you whether or not you were listening to the NBC, CBS, ABC network. They all had their individual known inaccuracies, offsets, and so on. So it's a relative thing. It's a beautiful art and science. You can get pretty deep into it, and it'll never be perfect. Just like measuring the accuracy of your yardstick, no matter how hard you try, it'll never be perfect. You can make it better and better. So frequency accuracy is sort of one of those. I know this is somewhat left of center what you asked, but maybe some of this information helps a little bit. Go ahead with the rest of your question, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. Well, the rest of the question was, can you get yourself a piece of paper? And if I give you this information over the air of what I have sitting in front of me, you might be able to look at what I have written down and see that there's sort of a pattern that sort of is being established here. Can you do that?
I've got paper in front of me. I got pencil. I've got a good set of earphones. I'm hearing a 50 dB signal-to-noise ratio signal coming from RYY. Fire away, Joe.
Okay, I'm going to try to give you these quick, so I don't time out the machine. I'll do like 5 or 6 of a clip. First frequency, 494.309429.0. Second frequency, 512.309429.8. Third frequency, 518.309442.6. Fourth frequency, 524.309434.6. Fifth frequency, 536.309434.5. You got those so far? I'll give you some more as I can continue the list.
Yeah, the .3094 and the hard numbers, the digits, the integers that are in front of it, I am guessing what I'm listening to is individual UHF digital television channel numbers, and the pilot tone is a fraction 0.3094 away from the lower end of the band, a certain number of megahertz, I think it's 1.3094, and so I noticed that some of them are very close, some of them are further away, and when we get a chance to talk to Eric, I'm pretty sure we'll get a chance to find out what is the real FCC requirement for that accuracy, what happens when that accuracy gets degraded. I know that when your digital television receiver, your demodulator, the first thing it probably does is to search and lock up to that pilot tone, because the frequency and the phasing of that pilot tone is one of the early steps of your receiver demodulating that digital signal so that I can get the multiple pieces of video and audio information that are contained in that broadcast channel. I am guessing, if I know you, Joe, that these are over-the-air frequencies that you measured, that if you were measuring these, let me drop.
Can I give you the rest of them?
You may not have to, but let me finish what I was saying. I'm guessing you were measuring these over the air. And if you were measuring through a cable system, which does other frequency conversions with other oscillators, you would get other offsets in some cases. So some of these have got fairly big and fairly small offsets from the 3094 blank, 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 which is the usual defined pilot tone frequency. What do you believe I will gain if you give me 10 more of these, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
You'll see the pattern that I'm looking at.
Okay, fire away with a few more.
What was the last frequency I gave you, 536 and change?
536, 3094, 345, as I remember.
All right, 342.3094, 34.5. So that's the same as the last one. Next one, 554.3094, 22.4. Next one, 566.3094, 29.6. Next one, 578.3094, 29.7. Next one, 584.3094, 39.0. 602.3094, 30.3. Next one, 614.3094, 29.7. Next one, 614. 626.3094, 29.7. Next one, only two more to go. 644.3094, 65.7. And last one, 650.3094, 29.2. So if you look at the whole list, you see that some of these things are they're almost the same frequency. I'm using a heterodyning method with my service monitor. I'm measuring this stuff off the air, so I'm not going through a cable system. And what I believe the way the process I'm using to measure these things is that accurate down to about maybe 1 or 2 tenths of a hertz. And I've left the service monitor on today specifically for about 6 hours, so it's very, very thermally stabilized. Okay? So if you do look down the list here, you can see that some of these frequencies are very, very close, if even the same from one to another. Others are the same with respect to other carriers, but they're not all the same across the entire list. And that's where my question sort of gets derived from. How do you really know, who's right and who's not right?
It is a slightly more basic problem to be considered here, Joe. When you're using your service monitor that's been warmed up for 6 hours and stabilized for measuring frequency, it has an internal reference oscillator. Maybe it's a 10 megacycle ovenized oscillator. Maybe it's made by Hewlett-Packard or some other respected high-quality, low-stability, high-stability, high-Q oscillator manufacturer. All oscillators have an aging characteristic. You make the measurement of that oscillator fully warmed up today, a year from now, and 10 years from now, you'll get a slightly different frequency as the oscillator ages. So the the amount of offset during these measurements that you probably measured all within 1 or 2 days. Let me drop.
No, I measured these measures with about 15 minutes time, after about a 5 to 6 hour warm-up.
Yeah, the point I'm making is that you made these measurements over a short enough period of time that the aging rate of your reference oscillator inside of your service monitor probably is not a factor. However, by what means do you believe the reference oscillator inside of your Hertz service monitor was set? Yes, you've got a calibration sticker on the front panel. It was calibrated within the right number of weeks ago, and that trace and that secondary standard is now traceable to the bureau. But what do you believe is the accuracy with which that reference oscillator inside of your service monitor was set? Have you ever compared it to National Bureau standards, for instance, an open-the-air broadcast at 2.5, 5, 10, 15 megahertz? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, trying to do that over HF frequency, which my service monitor can receive, I put it onto my outside antenna system, it can receive 2.5, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 megahertz, and look at WWV. I can look at that. The problem is with signal fading, it becomes very, very difficult to know whether you're off frequency and you're a 10th, 2/10, 3/10, 5/10 off frequency, or you're getting signal fading. At least as far as I understand it, it becomes very difficult. That's why I've used a much, much higher frequency to try to determine, you know, I'm looking here at the list. I'm looking at measuring. I'm able to measure the frequency difference of all these different carriers. And as you can tell, like the last, almost the last three, two and three are very close to each other, 30.3, 29.7, 29.7. And then you have another one, 644, 309.4, 65.7. That's way off. Next carrier that's up, 650, 309.4, 29.2. So, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Some of these things are very, very close, within tenth of a hertz of frequency of each other, and some are way, way off. And that's, I guess, what you're going to need the broadcast engineer's opinion on this. Who's right and who's wrong as the over-the-air frequency is being generated? The idea is what I'm trying to do here, Dick, is I'm trying to use them as a reference to accurately set my service monitor after a very, very long warm-up to say, okay, at 600, 700 megahertz, I may be only 1 hertz off frequency if I can determine these carriers off the air, who is right and who is not right. Back to you.
Quick question, Dick. Yeah, go ahead, John. And John, by the way, you're a guy who makes sure that all of your equipment is traceable to the bureau in specification, in time specification of your calibration stickers on your equipment in your laboratory. So you've run into this problem. Let's see how you solve this. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, Dick, I have. I just have one question for Joe. Joe, after you finished that 15-minute survey, did you go back and check, like, the first two that you started with to see if you got exactly the same numbers? Did you do that also? That's my only question. Back to you, Dick.
Yes, I did. And what I will get is the measurable drift of the oscillator inside my service monitor. It's not perfect, and it doesn't stay exactly put where it's supposed to be. But it seems to be holding thermally at an accuracy rate of less than a half a hertz or a quarter of a hertz from one to the other. I do get repeatability within a very, very small fraction of a hertz, maybe 0.2, 0.3 hertz off. And that I would equate to the internal oscillator moving very slightly with temperature drift, or just, you know, how it specifically is working. I wouldn't expect the oscillator in this thing to hold right on at a tenth of a hertz at 600 megahertz and hold that repeatably. It doesn't have that kind of stability to be able to give that kind of repeatability. But if I know by the measuring the frequency difference that I measured off the air, I can see differences between carriers very accurately. I don't know if they're all correct or all not correct. That's what the question is. Why I'm basically asking this question, to try to determine who out of this list of frequencies I gave Dick seems to be the most correct. It's supposed to be, from when Eric had told me a while ago on the tech, that it's supposed to be 309.441 and change. Well, 0.441 would be down to 1 hertz, so I'm measuring less than that. But if I know which one of these is correct or not correct, it would give me a better way of steering, you know, as far as knowing what to do here with setting the time based on my service monitor.
Good, Joe. It sounds like you did the correct job. The only other question I have, Dick, is when Joe did that, did he find the drift exactly the same within that range that he checked? Like if he checked the first and the third frequency, was the drift in the same direction, approximately the same count?
I'll answer directly, John. Yes, yes. If the oscillator was going a little higher in frequency, everything would go high this about the same by the same amount of rate, within 0.1 or 0.1, 0.1, 0.2 hertz. I would see that kind of repeatability. The instrument, the specifications from IFR, they only tell you to set it within 100 hertz. If it's 100 hertz at a gig, they call that okay. Well, I'd like to get a little closer than that if I could possibly can. So I'm trying to measure something down to a tenth of hertz and get repeatability. I think I'm probably asking the instrument to do a little more than I'm really, than it was ever made to do. But the whole point here is, when I'm measuring off the air, I don't know which one is exactly correct or not correct. That's why I gave Dick the whole list of frequencies here. And as you heard the same thing, some of these things do measure and give repeatability of the same frequency. Some are also at a different frequency, but they're all very close to each other within themselves.
Very good, Joe. Okay, Dick, back to you.
A slightly naive person here would use what's called majority logic. He'd look at the apparent list of all of these frequencies, and he would find that of the 15 television channels he measured, 5 of them appeared to be all tightly grouped. And he could make a judgment that, those 5 guys, since they're all so tightly grouped to each other, probably have a real good traceability back to the Bureau of Standards with a real good reference cesium beam oscillator or whatever. And so those could very well be the ones that are accurate and everyone else is the outlier. You could come to that conclusion, but you'd be doing it with a risk factor because those 5 guys might all be sniffing the same glue. They may all be comparing to each other and not worrying so much about traceability to the Bureau. So they may all be off by the same amount. So are they the best reference? That's left to be discovered. What we're running into here is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Let me give you a couple of words on what I mean by that. I think his name was Werner Heisenberg, back in the days when they were first starting to study atomic level physics, and he suddenly realized that an electron is an extremely small, extremely light, highly charged, fast-moving particle, and that now you want to really measure what's going on your particular hydrogen atom. You're studying the living daylight out of this hydrogen atom inside of your chamber, inside of your laboratory. And you'd like to know how fast is that electron moving around that nucleus and that hydrogen atom, in my example. And he soon discovered that you've got a problem. You might be able to take a whole lot of time, take a whole lot of readings, and measure the average velocity of that electron. Or, correspondingly, if you think you know what is its cyclic rate going around that atom, you could measure a whole lot of those individual cycles. But he soon concluded, you cannot know the exact position of that electron at any one instant of time. And you can choose one of two things. You can know the exact position, or you can know the exact velocity, in theory, if you do the experiment just right. You can never know both at the same time. Now, I ran into a similar problem when I brought home this frequency counter, the best one Hewlett-Packard, that Airborne Instrument Amateur loaned at the time. Let me drop. I brought home this frequency counter that had something like 10 decimal places to it, and I intended to measure the exact frequency coming out of the reference oscillator in my digital watch, because I wanted my digital watch to have, if at all possible, a fraction of a second of accuracy per month. My son Christopher and I suddenly developed interest in our new digital Armatron watches. This is way back in 1972 or something like that, and we wanted to see what kind of accuracy we could get out of it. And I soon recognized that as I put any kind of a probe near the basic oscillator inside the digital watch, the capacitive loading and resistive loading and the proximity effects of the oscilloscope probe that I was putting near the oscillator, loaded down the oscillator and made it shift to another frequency. So I noticed, I soon realized I couldn't do the direct measurement. I soon realized that the only way I could really set the accuracy of the clock is to measure what was the drift rate per day, per week, per month, and then reset its little variable capacitor in there and hope I was going in the right direction. And by a step-by-step process, I did get it down to approximately 1 second per month of accuracy if I continuously wore the watch. If I took the watch off my wrist at night and set it on the nightstand, it would cool off and run at a different rate. So if I took enough time, I could measure its accuracy. I couldn't do it in any one measurement at any one sitting with this highly accuracy frequency counter, because the frequency counter disturbed the circuit and varied the oscillator accuracy that I was looking for. Let me drop. Now, let's assume now that you are running the equivalent of the National Bureau of Standards in Paris, France, and you want to use as the reference the transmission frequencies coming out of the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado, for the United States. How would you do that? Well, nowadays, you would do it by satellite, but in those days, you know that the ionosphere is sending you that signal on 2.5, 5, 10, 15 megacycles. That's the good news. You know that the ionosphere is giving you periodic fades where the signal goes to zero and comes back. You know that the ionosphere is going up and down in altitude, and therefore the number of bounces of that signal between Boulder, Colorado and Paris, France, the number of bounces and the total path length is going up and down. So at first you'd say, wow, I don't stand a chance with all these variables. Mother Nature is really going to screw me up something royal in this particular situation. Well, you've got, again, if you use Heisenberg, his principles in the right direction, there's a way you can get around this. Let me drop. And that is, in that particular case of setting that precise oscillator in Paris, using Boulder as a standard, if you do it for a long enough period of time, like I did with Christopher and I did with our Armatron watch, by waiting for a month and looking at the drift rate, we were able to find out the integrated answer. The instantaneous answer, you're not going to get it, but the integrated answer you can. You know that even though you're going to get a dropout of the signal between Boulder and Paris, you know that when it comes back, it's going to come back on the same frequency. So if you've got an accurate enough, let me call it phase lock loop oscillator, that has a good enough glide ratio, so to speak, so that when the signal drops out, your local oscillator keeps gliding through the dropout, and when it comes back, it reestablishes lock. You know that the you're not going to slip cycles that way as long as your local oscillator is high enough in accuracy at the time of the dropout. By the same token, even though the ionosphere is going up and down in altitude, the total number of bounces and the total deflection of the signal due to diffraction effects between Boulder and Paris, that's going up and down hour to hour, minute to minute, day to day. But if you integrate for a long enough period of time, all of that washes out. So if you're willing to spend enough time with a known accuracy, you can reestablish a secondary accuracy of almost the identical accuracy of the known accuracy, even though the propagation medium between you and it is something really terrible in amplitude and phase and path length. Let me drop. Because you know that on a one-month period, it has to keep coming back. The total number of miles in between Boulder and Paris is not going to change. No, it's going to change by a fraction of an inch per year because of plate tectonics movement. But even that's predictable, if you know what I mean. And even if you're using a geosynchronous satellite, the geosynchronous satellite, the accuracy of the satellite is a problem. You think the satellite is in a perfectly circular orbit directly above the equator. Well, if the guy's doing the positioning of the satellite and doing their job, and they've got enough position accuracy gas left over, and they're willing to keep getting to the middle of their cube of where they're supposed to be. Each one of those geosynchronous satellites is supposed to be within roughly a one-mile cube. And Intelsat will charge you a penalty if you wander out of that cube that's assigned to you, because now you're starting to become a hazard to other nearby satellites. You've got to stay on your particular address. Well, many of those satellites are moving in a figure eight pattern where there's a little bit of apogee and perigee and a little bit of tilt to the orbit and so on. So even the phasing of the signal, you're getting maybe you're using a 10.5 gigahertz signal, reference tone coming out of that satellite. It's a hell of a lot better over a short period of time than listening to Boulder, Colorado for a week or a month. But even it has a drift to it, and it's got a periodicity because no satellite is perfectly positioned all the time. Therefore, the distance between that satellite and you is continuously going up and down in azimuth elevation. We could call it right ascension and declination and altitude. Everything is changing. Mother Nature, nothing in this universe was made simple for you and I to measure and understand on the first crack, if you know what I mean, Joe. Let me drop.
And I have a message from the chat room, Dick.
J2B with a comment.
Okay, J2B recognized and John recognized. So, as you can see, there's an art in science to what techniques you use, what timing of those techniques you use, how long you're willing to spend getting it, how good is your reference, how traceable is your reference. Does everybody in the world agree with your particular reference? As you can see, there's no exact answer here. You can put forth more and more effort. You'll get higher and higher accuracy. You'll never get it perfect. And you'll never get everybody to agree that the technique you're using is the best of all techniques. Hey, John, what have you heard from the chat room? I'm not a pro in this subject, but when it comes to the way that they measure the accuracy between oscillators, it's usually called the Allen paired variance technique. In other words, if you think you have an oscillator that has a certain distribution of its frequency, it's called frequency spectral purity. In other words, if you looked at your oscillator on the world's best spectrum analyzer, let me drop. If you look at your oscillator on the world's best spectrum analyzer, and if your oscillator was perfect, you would see a pure vertical line of infinitesimal width on the screen at that frequency. You'd see nothing else. Well, let's get real. A real spectrum analyzer has a reference oscillator inside that has a little bit of squitter to it. In other words, each cycle is not exactly the same number of nanoseconds, picoseconds, femtoseconds, and so on. There's a little bit of variation in the basic oscillator of your spectrum analyzer. And the thing that you're measuring has a little bit of a spectral spread to it. As such, you're going to get a Gaussian-shaped curve on that screen, on that spectrum analyzer screen, for the signal you're looking at. And as your oscillator that you're measuring gets better and better, and as your spectrum analyzer gets better and better, the spread, the standard deviation, the distance between the left-hand skirt and the right-hand skirt of that display of that signal on that screen is going to get more and more narrow, but it's never going to get perfect. There's a certain spectral spread to every single oscillator. Let's see, John, KC2WGB, what have you heard from the chat room? And I hope they're going to correct us on all this. KQRIW, the tech man.
KC2WGB. Yes, Jay has sent a note that explains that, like, Channel 18 seems to be fixed by GPS. That's a requirement. Some stations don't have that requirement. Okay, there's a little reason for it. Plus, he said that they have offsets. Some are slightly plus, some are slightly negative, some have zero offset. So that could account for some of that discrepancy that Joe's seeing on his analyzer. But just some information from the chat room.
In the days of over-the-air analog television, each individual analog channel had a known offset frequency. Therefore, if you're watching Channel 2 and you're starting to get long-range propagation, you're starting to see Channel 2 from Washington, D.C., and Chicago, Illinois, and Missouri, and Kansas, and whatever, because of the offset, you would get a certain number of black bars across the screen when those two television signals meet against each other. And if you knew whether or not your local CBS television, Channel 2 in New York City, was a negative, zero, or positive offset, and whether or not you got a small number, a zero number, or a large number of bars on the screen, it gave you a strong clue as to where the other co-channel interference signal was coming from. If you knew that a certain number of bars represented a total of 20 KC of offset, which would be you being low and the other one being high, I think they had 10 KC offsets, then you would be able to make a good guess as to where that signal was coming from. So there was intentional offsetting then with analog. whether or not there's an equivalent these days with digital television. Maybe Joe's going to tell us about that. She'll be WJ2B, K2LIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Very good, Dick. I just wanted to throw my two cents into this subject here. I don't know if you've heard about these GPS disciplined clocks that they use at cell sites. I believe it's in mostly CDMA. I don't know about the other types, but this, I'm looking at the spec of the one that I have right now, and it's called a Trimble Thunderbolt GPS disciplined clock. And basically, it was surplus equipment refurbished that I bought from a vendor in China. And the spec on it is after one day of averaging, it can give you 1.16 times 10 to the minus 12 hertz accuracy on the 10 megahertz output. And the 1 hertz, there's also a 1 hertz, one pulse per second output that gives you 1 sigma of 20 nanoseconds. And the phase noise at 10, plus or minus 10, at 10 hertz, the phase noise is minus 120 dBc per hertz. And basically there's, you know, I opened it up, there's a 10 megahertz ovenized oscillator in there. If you hook up the RS-232 jack and use their software, it tells you what the accuracy is. The offset voltage, it takes the 1 pulse per second from the GPS satellite, it averages it all together, it has a 12-channel GPS receiver, averages all the pulses, the one pulse per second from all the GPS satellites, and then it uses that to apply the offset for the 10 megahertz ovenized oscillator that's in there, and it'll give you extremely high accuracy. If you have it running for a day, you know, better than 10 to the minus 12 hertz. So, not if you ever heard of these things, but you can get one off of eBay. I don't know if they still sell them. I got one like quite a few years ago for about $180 off of eBay, and it can give you extremely high accuracy. But you have to have an outside GPS antenna, though, for it. WJ2B.
You know, Joe, you just brought up a very good point. Because of the way the cellular telephone system works, they need a local reference oscillator of extremely high accuracy in order to not have dropped calls when they do a handoff from one cell site to another. They've got to know the exact frequency and the exact phase of the signal coming from your mobile cell phone as you travel in your automobile, so to speak. Of course, you're using a hands-free phone, and you're being handed off between one cell site and another. They need extreme accuracy. The possibility exists that the frequency accuracy of the standard reference oscillator at cell sites might be considerably higher than the what we used to think was the high standard. That was a broadcast, television broadcast signals. As such, Joe, do you know of a way that W-H-Y-Y, Joe, could be listening to signals from a cell site and find out a frequency reference? In other words, if this is the best of all worlds, that local cell site 5 miles from his house would give him a nice piece of cable that goes over to his house with the output of their reference oscillator after a buffer amplifier. That's the best of all site situations. Now, in reality, as he being a cell phone user outside of the cell site, is there a way that he can listen to signals from that cell site and get access to that reference oscillator, so to speak? Do you think that's possible, Joe? WJ2B, K2RIW, the TechNet.
No, Dick, I never heard of anybody doing that. I'm not an expert on cellular, equipment that's in those sites, but as far as I know, they have one of these ovenized GPS disciplined oscillators at the cell site, and they use that as their reference. They either use the 10 megahertz or the 1 pulse per second, into their other equipment to reference, give them an extremely accurate reference. And the reason that it's so accurate is that the GPS satellites have an extremely accurate cesium clock in each satellite. So that gives the GPS system a very accurate way to determine, the distance and coordinates to each satellite to give you a very accurate indication of your latitude and longitude. So basically, you can buy one of these little boxes off of eBay. It takes +5, -12, and +12, and there's an ovenized oscillator. So even if it loses, if you disconnect the antenna, it'll free run and it'll stay, at the setting that it was right before you disconnected it. So it's called holdover. and it will give you an extremely accurate 10 megahertz, to use as a reference for a frequency counter or a frequency generator or a service monitor. So, like I said, you can pick one up on eBay for about $170, $180. They used to be. I haven't looked lately. I don't know if they're still selling them, but I've never heard anybody trying to hook up to a cell site. I don't think they would let you go anywhere near it. But the only way you could maybe get any kind of reference out of a cell site would be on the transmit frequency. If that's, if it's highly accurate and locked to, the reference of that disciplined, GPS disciplined reference oscillator, then it's possible the cell site frequency, output might be extremely accurate. But being that it's digital, it's jumping around, I don't think you can, if it was the days of the analog cell phone, maybe you could get a lock on.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WHYY with a comment. Reference that. If one of these, the GPS discipline oscillators, that's kind of state of the art. Either that, or you got to spend like a few thousand dollars and get your own cesium, or there's a couple of other technologies you can get for a really expensive disciplined oscillator with like cesium in it or something. But these little GPS discipline units are not too expensive on eBay. Back over you to WJ2.
Joe number one and Joe number two both recognized. And Joe, the last guy who just talked, you came close to timing out the second cycle, and we had to reset the machine. I can tell you're on one of your favorite subjects. We've come a long way. In the early days of our Hallicrafter SX100 receiver, you had a built-in 100 KC crystal oscillator, which it gave you every 10 KC or so across the dial, it gave you a signal you could listen to in order to set the reference of the signals you're listening to. Pretty soon we've come along with listening to WWV broadcast systems. And when it comes to the chain of higher and higher accuracy oscillators, I see a trend here. Broadcast television used to be one of the very high standards, the 3.579545 chrominant subcarrier that was used on analog television color broadcast used to be an extremely good reference oscillator in its day. Let me drop it. Hey, Jerry Jack. Yeah, Eric, you're the guy I'm looking for to give us some of the answers to some of the questions that Joey's been asking. And now, the high accuracy reference oscillator inside of a cell site is another one of higher accuracy probably than broadcast. It's my guess. Eric's going to correct me on that one. However, because it's a digital signal without necessarily a pilot tone coming out of the cell site, getting access to that oscillator in the outside world is difficult. But a deep global positioning satellite disciplined oscillator, in other words, by listening to the global positioning satellite signal, which is probably one of the highest accuracy things we have access to, and over a period of time, letting that stabilize your local cesium standard, that may be the best thing you can get. And I bet you're at your broadcast station, they've got one of those. Is that true, Eric? And by the way, if you heard listened earlier, when Joe was listening all the 10 or 15 UHF television over-the-air broadcast signals he listened to, 578.3094297, and the next one is 3094350, and so on. They all were offset a little bit from each other, and he was asking questions about that. Give us information on any of the above, Eric. We're looking forward to hearing what you got to say. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, the GPS discipline oscillator that I use is actually after, I think it's about 6 hours, you get 10 to the minus 14 at 10 megahertz. There's one thing I want to warn you guys about. If you do some arithmetic, and you take your 10 megahertz, and you multiply that up to, say, a cell phone frequency, or even a ham radio frequency, what are the devices that they are using? So, if you've got some frequency that's not necessarily a division that's being used, actually, probably a phase lock oscillator, that's referenced with the 10 megahertz, and whatever the device is in the phase lock loop is,
you may get a frequency, let's say we're going for 147 even. It actually might be 146.999995 or something like that, depending upon the divider that they choose to use. So you got to watch that. Let me listen if you can catch you a little bit there. Let me drop. As far as when you went back to mentioning color burst, because I actually didn't hear your conversation a little earlier, you will find that if you had tuned to CBS, anything that was coming from the network, you would find a very highly accurate 358-579-545, because it was driven by a rubidium standard in its day. So when I rebuilt Channel 13, I was fortunate enough that Bill Baker used to like to collect cesium oscillators from the Naval Observatory, so I still even have one of the cesium oscillators in my house. And that was pretty damn accurate. But, of course, as you put one cesium oscillator next to each other, there may be a slight little bit of offset between each one and the cesium oscillator that the Naval Observatory uses a phaseable, so that way they can lock two or three of them up together and do the averaging, and that's actually what happened at NIST. Now, as far as I know about cell phones, the GPS reference is more for timing rather than frequency. Whereas, from what I understand, that LTE is very important to have everything happening at the same time so that you can have this multiplex business going on. K2RIWK2J.
You brought up some interesting points there, Eric. What I can tell what Joe is doing, I can tell by the repeatability he got when he answered John's question of going back to the same UHF television broadcast, digital television pilot tones, and he went back 10 minutes later and he got a fraction of a hertz of difference out of 600 megahertz. You go through the mathematics of that, it means that he's in the vicinity of 5 parts per 10 to the 10 is the accuracy of repeatability that John was getting with. Here we go. That Joe was getting with his service monitor. And what WJ2B was telling us about, and you were indicating, 10 to the 14 is a disciplined, a global positioning satellite disciplined cesium beam or rubidium beam oscillator. And that, I think, is getting pretty close to the best you can do. So I guess the recommendation, Joe, is that you've got all kinds of friends and all kinds of places, ham radio-wise. Some of them are in the broadcast industry and whatever. And by hook or by crook, you're eventually going to get your hands on a global positioning satellite disciplined oscillator system. There's been a few articles also. Let me drop this. There's been a few articles in QEX magazine, the ARRL magazine of the electronic experiment. There's been a few articles there as to how to homebrew disciplined oscillators, GPS disciplined oscillators. Guys are buying relatively inexpensive GPS navigating systems and tapping into them where there's a reference oscillator inside that when you're locked up to a satellite, that oscillator is by definition being disciplined, and then they suck out that signal in order to take their reference for their laboratory and make it very accurate. So there are ways you can homebrew this, and you can get, I'll bet you 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13, maybe even approaching 10 to the 14 oscillator accuracy by way of GPS disciplined techniques, Joe. So I think that's the direction you're going to be moving if you continue to pursue this particular hobby of yours, accuracy hobby. What's the best accuracy you can get? That's sort of what I think you're moving in that direction, and you're curious.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
I got one more thing to say too.
Okay, so you're going to be John and Eric in that order. Go ahead, John.
DC2WGB. I would like to see if Joe, maybe he's already tried this, but I would like every 3 days, under the same circumstances with the equipment, meetings, maybe for a week, week and a half, and see if the relationship stays the same. That'll be another good indicator, and we'll also check the amount of drift.
Can I say something, Dick?
You called it drift, I would call it aging. Go ahead, we're going to go to Joe and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. First of all, I've used the cell